The new year is as much a time to look forward as it is to look back. What are we going to do differently in 2024? Where do we leave money on the table in 2023? As you craft your strategy to make 2024 the best year yet, consider leveraging better tools to get a better outcome. Yelp Guest Manager pairs the largest consumer network in the country with reservation and waitlist software designed to ensure you're as busy as possible. From large parties to last-minute diners, capture 100% of the demand for your restaurant. To see the growth potential for your restaurant, visit restaurants.yelp.com/full comp for a free evaluation and start 2024 strong. Now here we go.
You get so much out of people and you get so much satisfaction, or at least I do, and Eric does, out of seeing people excel and thrive, that I think if we could understand that, yes, the kitchen should be a respectful environment where we can all feel good.
Welcome to Full Comp, a show offering insight into the hospitality industry, featuring restaurateurs, thought leaders, and innovators. Served up on the house. Are you on track to hit your profitability goals for this year? If you're struggling to hit your numbers, I might be able to help. Here's how I do it. Every year, I offer 5 complimentary growth sessions to restaurant owners looking to scale. In this call, we'll examine your current situation to see what is and isn't working. We'll identify your growth possibilities by the close of the year. We'll uncover the number one thing holding you and your business back. And we'll develop a growth plan that will get your business results. Go to planwithjosh.com to schedule one of the 5 complimentary growth sessions. They're going to go quickly. They always do. Chef Bruce Bromberg is not the typical restaurant magnate that comes to mind when you think of a national restaurant group. More than anything, he's a chef, leveraging the universal truths he's learned over the years in innovative ways. His ability to translate the fundamentals of cooking to the fundamentals of business have led to his meteoric success. Today, we sit down to discuss the essential elements involved in building a restaurant brand and business that can last decades.
My brother and I both grew up in this very food-centric, Francophile home where food was critical to life, and food was, it was a luxury, it was a treat, it was a privilege in our house. Every meal was revered. And growing up, whether it was my grandparents who came over from Eastern Europe, or just our dad and mom and the way food was kind of treated in our household, it always had a certain level of reverence. And Eric and I both had a really great childhood, and we were taken out to all these cool restaurants, assuming we behaved. So it was just a big part of our lives. And I think when Eric first finished college, he had always been interested in cooking, and Eric and I together had always been interested in cooking. But I think back in, like, Eric finished school in 84, it wasn't like, oh, the culinary arts, that's a direct path for you to take. It was certainly fringe. And one thing led to another, and his really good and our really good childhood friends, our best friends as a family, my dad's partner, my mom's best friend, Eric's best friend, my best friend, was all this one other family. But the daughter of this other family had graduated the same year as Eric, and she wanted to go to cooking school in Paris. And her dad didn't want to send her alone to Paris. And so my brother graduated at the same time and had no real clear path as to what he was going to do. And the dad spoke, and one thing kind of led to another. And Eric wound up kind of being, originally was not the chaperone, but somebody to go and accompany Jennifer to go to Cordon Bleu. So Eric enrolled as well. And they had this just transformative, amazing experience in France. And my brother always tells the story that this was the first time he ever enjoyed any version of school at all. This was the revelation. He enjoyed being taught. He enjoyed learning. He enjoyed waking up and going to class and seeing, and then the practical class. He was just over the moon thrilled. And when Eric came back from France after a year and a half or so in France, he wound up coming back to New York and taking various jobs at old traditional French places like La Caravelle, and worked in these very similar, I think, to the kitchens he was working to in Paris. While that was going on, I was now in college and perhaps following a similar path as my brother of enjoying the social aspects, but not necessarily excelling in the academics of the whole thing. So when I graduated, it was a little up in the air as to what I was going to do or where I was heading. And my brother said to me, Dad is, him and my father had a place down in the south of France for some 20 years where he took us all. So France wasn't a foreign country to us, so to speak. It was kind of part of our childhoods too. So he suggested that I do the same and maybe it's something I would like as well. And I had graduated school. I went and I spent the summer. Eric was the chef at this point at the American Hotel in Sag Harbor. And I went out there and I was basically partying and sleeping on his sofa and not working. And one day, one of his cooks, one of the chef de partie, got sick. And it turned out he was going to be out of work for like 2.5 weeks. And it was the height of summer in the Hamptons in 1988, whatever it was, the summer of 88. And Eric just looked at me and he's like, all right, listen, get off the sofa and put on this chef coat and you're coming in. I need help. And I went in and it was like a Friday or a Saturday night. And it was just this just revelation of an experience where, holy shit, this was a blast. This was the most exciting. It was hard as shit. I didn't know what how to do anything, but it was like Eric and I playing as little kids, pretending we were Benihana chefs. Except for I had no experience and he was already the chef of a cool restaurant out in the Hamptons. But that was kind of the seed that did it. And I wound up going to Cordon Bleu a couple months after that. And I went with two of my high school friends. And I wound up spending about 3 years. And that brings us to 1992, which is when I returned from France, when Eric, who at this point now had a restaurant called Nick and Eddie in New York on the corner of Spring and Sullivan in Soho. And Nick and Eddie opened in 86 and was one of the hottest restaurants in New York. It was a corner bar that had real food. And this was kind of the beginning of that transition in New York, where it wasn't just fine dining French establishments and then burger places or Chinese places or Italian places. But this is where, this was the period when, you know, chefs started to kind of excel in more casual restaurant environments. And Nick and Eddie was certainly at the front of that. And Nick and Eddie was so popular and it was so hard to get into. And there was a 2-hour wait on Monday, on Saturday. It didn't matter. It was just a very busy restaurant all the time. And his partner, Peter Philip Hoffman, and his wife, Stephanie, and Eric found this little space directly across the street, catty corner across the street, that was two apartments that could be turned into a retail space. It was being converted to retail. So they conceived this whole restaurant called the Crystal Room. It was like a club, which is super hip today. And unfortunately, this thing was the opposite of him when it finally opened. And Eric called me and was like, dude, you've been in France for almost 3 years. Will you come back and help me open this new project I'm working on? So it was probably time for me to leave. I had been there for 3 years working in a bunch of different places and after graduating Cordon Bleu. So I flew back to New York. We spent 6 weeks in the kitchen getting the menu together, and we opened up this place in May of 92 called the Crystal Room. And the Crystal Room had many, many negative stories. But the good story was, I think we made really good food. The negative was, it was this closed down, you couldn't see in it. It was this private little kind of clubby atmosphere. But unfortunately, the decor wasn't very nice. It didn't really work. And in a matter of 10 weeks, it was gone. And Philip stopped coming over, and he was back at Nick and Eddie, and Eric and I and the team were trying to make this thing work. One day, there was just no money to pay payroll, and the whole thing went up in flames. And my brother at 27 years old had a couple $100,000 in debt as his first restaurant. And, you know, what he and some of our family friends invested in this thing. And it was just a disaster. It was a horrible thing. And I never intended on staying in New York. My plan, I had gone to school in Boulder, Colorado. My plan was always come back from France and go to Boulder. I wanted to someday just open a restaurant there. I loved that city. New York wasn't really on my radar. But that night that we were all sitting in the restaurant in this defunct, bankrupt mess of a place, one of the food runners, this guy, Sean Santamore, said, you know, what's wrong with this place is it's the design and that, you know, why would you put a wall here? Why wouldn't you open this up? And we actually still had a fair amount of the construction equipment in the basement because the contractors, that's how new the restaurant was. We were still doing work. And by the end of that night, we had demoed out most of that restaurant. We had tore down all the walls.
Oh, my God.
We had, like, made an absolute mess of this place. And, you know, it was while consuming whatever we were consuming at that time, kind of drowning our sorrows. So probably wasn't the safest work and construction environment ever. But Eric and I came in that next day and looked at what we had done. And it was, you know, Eric looked at me and said, why don't you stay in New York and be my partner and let's make the restaurant we want to make. And that wound up basically 4 months later being Blue Ribbon. I think we raised another $50,000 or $60,000 from our investors, and we turned it around and we built Blue Ribbon by ourselves. Basically, I mean, we just tore it down to the studs and the kitchen was already set. All the mechanicals were in, so it was really just a facelift. But we did it and we reopened Blue Ribbon on November 3rd, 1992.
It's such an important lesson. I was reading these letters that John Rockefeller had sent to his son. It's these private letters, which were ultimately published in a book. And one of the things that he tells his son is that whatever your initial idea is, it's just an idea. It's never going to work as planned. But I think for so many of us, we get so attached. I've talked about it on the show before, but momentum is dangerous, right? Because if it's sending you in the right direction, great. But if it's sending you in the wrong direction, it's a disaster. And so many times we open restaurants, there's poor product market fit. And what you find is the guys like you that make the deviations early enough get to reap the benefits. But it's hard to admit that you're wrong and then go seeking the answers when you're in the middle of what is arguably a dumpster fire.
Yeah, I think, and Eric and I always say, like, that failure is probably the most important thing that ever happened to us as restaurateurs. It was like, we had this vision. And the weird thing about the Crystal Room was we were just kind of creating food for the sake of creating food. It wasn't so much our vision, so to speak. That was like that momentum going, this is this exclusive club, blah, blah, blah. We just were like, okay, well, we know how to make cool food. I just came back from working in 2 and 3 Michelin star restaurants in France. I was like, you know, but it wasn't like coming from my heart and soul or Eric's heart and soul. So we got into this thing, and when it all went south, it was that lesson of don't just freaking jump in. Take your time on these things and understand what it is you really want to do and why it's important to you. And I think when we made Blue Ribbon, I mean, one of the things that was crazy about the making of Blue Ribbon was we were building it, and we weren't great builders. We had a workshop when we were kids. We knew how to do stuff, but we didn't know the whole thing. So we were like so focused on that. You know, it almost took our focus away from what we were doing. The only thing we knew we wanted to make was a restaurant that everyone was comfortable in, and a restaurant that resonated to us. We didn't know what the menu was going to be. It wasn't American. It wasn't French. It wasn't Italian. It wasn't Spanish. We're just going to make this cool ass place that is fun. I mean, I was 24. Eric was 28 maybe at this point. We just want a place that was festive, you could party at, and there was good food. And it wasn't until my brother's wife, Ellen, like 5 days from the opening, was like, guys, there's no menu. What is this place? You know, what is it? And Eric and I sat down and we wrote this menu in an hour. And it's the menu that we're still serving 30 freaking 1 years later, right? But the reason that it all worked was because we sat there and we asked each other questions. It was like, what was your favorite meal? What was your favorite birthday dinner? What was the best thing grandma ever made? What was the coolest thing from that trip we did in Colorado? Or, you know, it was like, and it was just this memory, walk down culinary memory lane. And when we wound up, it was this kind of bizarre, eclectic assemblage of different ideas. But because they were our ideas, it was our memories, it came together in a cool way. And it was that focus that I think gave this kind of bizarre eclectic menu credence, and also this restaurant that was in a way trying to make everyone happy, kind of a cool thing in work that's not always an easy thing to do. You can trip up a lot, and I think a lot of people trying to maybe emulate that, and since then it has been complicated. But for us, it's almost like that first album where you had all this bottled up in you for all these years, right? And it was just that kind of divine moment of, here, this would be cool. This is it. This is, you know, these are the tunes. These are the dishes that mean something to us. And it definitely has resonated over the years. And it's amazing that all this time has passed and it still feels pretty darn relevant.
So at this time, you and your brother are in your 20s, and you've been brothers for certainly longer than 30 years, but you've been business partners for 30 years, which I would assume is an interesting and at times a difficult dynamic. But what I found is the best businesses typically have the healthiest partnerships. So how has that relationship with your brother, I guess, improved, evolved over the years? What are the secrets to success there? That way, it's not awkward in the middle of a busy push or Thanksgiving.
Yeah. I think we're extraordinarily blessed, lucky. I don't know what it is, but Eric's 5 years older than me, and I've always, in a sense, kind of been the little brother. We kind of understand where we stand in the relationship, if you know what I mean. I don't try to supersede those bigger brother things, and he doesn't try to be the little brother. So when we went into business, our dad was super concerned, super, super concerned. And he sat down with both of us and we went to his office. You know, it was one of those where you remember it. It was usually because I didn't hand my homework in or had done something horrible at school. But this was more his concern. He was excited we were both chefs, like that was his dream, but he didn't really see this one coming, I don't think. And he sat down and he just explained to us in no uncertain terms how concerned he was, because there was nothing more important than our relationship. And Eric and I had a significant fight in the very beginning. And I'd say it was a couple months into Blue Ribbon. We had Eric's wife with us. We all lived in the same house. I lived with them when they got married. I mean, you know, we've spent an awful lot of time together. But we had this huge fight in the restaurant and in the kitchen. And I remember clearly how it affected our staff when they saw that, guys who had been working for Eric for years. And everyone was just kind of like shocked and taken aback. And that was 1993. And we really haven't had any version of a significant fight since then. And I think we learned in that moment the impact we had on the space, on each other, how shitty that felt. And I was like, I'm going to Colorado. I know how to do all this shit. And he was like, no, you actually don't. And yeah, and of course, he was probably right. And I was being a pretentious young chef thinking I did know. But we realized that we had each other's backs and how valuable that was. And we've kind of worked at it. And we both have gotten to the point where when one of us believes strongly enough about something, we go with it. We're not super argumentative towards each other. We both do the same things. We grew up in the same house. We apprenticed at the same restaurants in Paris under the same chefs. We went to the same cooking school. We were on all the same Benihana birthday dinners together. We really, really come from the same place, to kind of an extreme degree. And I think it's just that respect, ultimately. I think it comes down to somewhat respect for our parents in a weird way. We just learned that it was just instilled in us from day one not to fight your brothers. You protected your brothers. And I think my older brothers always did protect me. And I always respected them for that. And in a way, you know, now our oldest brother, Ken, is our lawyer and has been with us, you know, for 20 years. And the 10 years prior to that, we just annoyed the crap out of him with questions while he was trying to be a partner in a firm. But yeah, it's like the three of us work together. And, you know, I'm not going to say there's never a moment where I'm a dick to him and he's a jerk to me. But we always, he's actually better at it than me, but he always calls me 10 minutes later and says, you know, sorry, I was a jerk or whatever it was, or I do the same thing. I'm sorry, I was aggressive or whatever. And we just get through it. And we understand that at the end of the day, we make our lives so much better. And quite honestly, we make the lives of the people around us better when we're together. We just don't mess with that.
Well, and over time, you begin to own the New York market, or at least a large share of it. Over the next 18 years, you're opening spots left and right. But at the 18-year mark, you decide to move outside of New York with your first location outside of the city. And so what prompted that? Because once you get really good at something, and you've done it for a couple of decades, conventional wisdom is keep doing what you're doing. It's working. What prompted the move outside of the state, and who did you have to become in order to make that venture successful?
Yeah, I mean, it was a really big one for us, right? We had these kind of 18 amazing years in New York. We were such a part of the New York culinary scene, and you know, everything was simple and easy, or as simple as it can be with, you know, five or six restaurants. But it was amazing, right? We were doing great. And over the years, we had had a number of Vegas and other things. Hey, come to Washington, come to Boston. You should do something in LA. Why aren't you guys in LA? We all have heard those things, right? And we actually, I think, flew out to see the Venetian one time or the Palazzo and one other casino. And Eric and I went out. We were just like, oh, hell no. Yeah, no, no interest. Don't want to do it. When the Cosmopolitan first approached us, I think it was about 3.5 to 4 years before we actually went. But what struck us as interesting was that, first off, the thing wasn't built yet. So we were getting in from the ground up, right? And that to us was an exciting prospect. And when we sat down and talked to the team, the story, which isn't that interesting, but the whole project went bankrupt in 2008 with the crash. And then Deutsche Bank came in, somebody else came in, they hired Related or some group to bring the restaurants on. But we were already basically on. We had a deal with that first group as the first restaurant to sign on to the Cosmopolitan. And what I thought was interesting is they were the first people who said to us, you don't need to Vegasize your restaurant. We are a different type of hotel. We're a different brand. We're uninterested. We're privately owned. We are focused on creating this kind of New York vibe, this totally different vibe in Vegas. And you don't need glitter, and you don't need pyrotechnics, and you don't need dry ice and all your dishes and sparklers. And that's the shit that freaked Eric and I out each time somebody approached us with the Vegas kind of things. So after a few conversations, we got really excited, and it was kind of an amazing thing. They brought this group of restaurateurs, and they discussed with each of us, who else do you think fits into this mold? Who else would be cool? And we put together a really amazing group in the beginning of Milos and Haleo and Scarpetta and us. And we were able to consult on what our whole floor felt like. And they just told all these restaurants to be themselves. And that is kind of what made it work. And then it was, how the hell do you actually do this, right? We had kind of pulled together and learned how to run Lower Manhattan and Brooklyn. We could couple of subway stops. We were at all our restaurants.
Right.
But now it's time zones and 2,500 miles away and all this stuff. And we certainly, because of naming all our restaurants the same thing, we didn't want to just put our name on the marquee and hope for the best. So I moved. I moved my wife and daughter to Vegas, and originally it was going to be for 6 months, and of course 4 years later and three restaurants and a music and food festival which almost killed me. But it was like we're not gonna open a place and just put our name on it and hope for the best. It has to have the exact same heart and soul. If we're going into a new city, we have to be present. And, you know, I went to work every single day for a year, at least. And I'm amazed that restaurant, that was sushi, that was Blue Ribbon Sushi. After about 7 years, it turned into Blue Ribbon Brasserie. I still have over half of the same employees from the beginning. You know, there's a bunch of 13-year employees. And I think ultimately that comes from the camaraderie and the understanding of the mission. And that was my goal moving to Vegas, was to create that same family, that same structure, that same respect for the restaurant, for each other. And yeah, I mean, it's hard, but that's really hard. It was not as easy not having Eric with me all the time. And it was a real learning experience. And then the same for Eric, not having me in New York all the time, right? That was kind of the beginning of where we started to divide and conquer a little bit. It still doesn't mean we tell each other what to do, or this is you and this is me. But obviously when I was living in Vegas, I was kind of front and center in dealing with Vegas more, and Eric in New York more than I was. So
when I interviewed Michael Mina, one of the things that he kept mentioning over and over again was a critical path, that once you've opened in multiple markets with familiar concepts that are familiar to you as the chef, that eventually you just figure out a system, and it doesn't work every time, but it works more often than not. Do you guys have that system at this point where you know that if you're going to be entering a new market with this particular concept, this is the square footage you need, this is what the infrastructure needs to look like, and this is the marketing plan?
No, not even a little bit.
You're killing me, Bruce. You're literally, literally killing me.
which is interesting. Yeah, it's kind of shocking. But no, we do not. And I will say, so just to take a quick step back, those first 18 years, we never looked at any version of financials. We didn't know basically what our food costs or our labor costs were. We had zero marketing. Not one single penny had ever been spent on marketing at Blue Ribbon in 18 years. We just literally opened restaurants, tried to make them as good as we possibly could. And that was it. That was our critical path. Is the food friggin' amazing? Is the service great? Does the place feel great? And our assumption was just that the rest would follow. Look, even when I opened Blue Ribbon, I was making more money than I ever thought I would make, right? Just being a chef, not whatever. I was getting a paycheck. I was like, damn, I'm single. I don't have, you know, any real costs. I've got money in the bank. I could buy a guitar if I wanted to. This is freaking amazing. We just didn't care. The very first time any of this became part of our landscape was the Cosmopolitan, because all of a sudden they were like, what's the marketing plan? And we were like, we have no freaking idea what the marketing plan is. We don't even know what that means. And so it was that realization. Inventory. To this day, we have never done inventory at Blue Ribbon, the original restaurant, not once, because inventory sucks. It's like a shitty thing. It's mindless. Yeah, I'm just like, when we opened Blue Ribbon, Eric and I sat there, we were like, what's all the shit that sucks about owning a restaurant? Let's get rid of it. People yelling at each other, inventory, front of the house, back of the house, chefs stealing mise en place, what all that shit, that oppressive world of, we were like, gone, goodbye, rules, get rid of them. I hate to say it, but 31 years later, we're still pretty much in that mindset. Now, with that said, our world has changed. There's been more high-profile operations, and yes, people require budgets now. And I promise you, Eric and I don't do them. But we'll answer questions so we can get to the right answers, but that's kind of where Brother Ken comes in. But it's just, no, there is no critical path. We've never done a demographic study. We don't look at the median income of people around the restaurant. We don't even necessarily do projections or know what our food costs. So we assume we can run a restaurant in a successful manner as long as we pay attention to the couple of things that we've always paid attention to. And that's our critical path.
Run me through those things. What are those things you're paying attention to?
I think first and foremost, it's the guest experience. In the adage, in the old saying, customer's always right. Unfortunately, I find it to be a lot of lip service 90% of the time. But it's ensuring that the customer has an extraordinary time and can forget about their problems. They don't come in and have to worry about their experience. They can just come in and enjoy our restaurant, their time in our restaurant, and walk out. And when they walk out, they're thinking about the next time they're coming back, who they're bringing, and what they're ordering, so to speak. So that's like key. Integrity of the kitchen and integrity of cuisine. We both, Eric and I, trained in these restaurants where maybe not the greatest restaurant in Paris, but we trained at this amazing one Michelin star restaurant where Eric stayed for a year and a half and I stayed for a year and a half, because the chef taught you respect and the kitchen was run respectfully. No one ever raised their voice in that kitchen. No one ever swore in that kitchen. And then I work in all these other places when I was apprenticing around France, where there's a 15-pound copper pot flying across the kitchen at some like 16-year-old little French kid. And I was just like, that's not cool. That's not going to be part of what I do. And so it's come down a lot, and I talk about it more than anything these days, which is just basic respect for the place, each other, and the customer. And that's kind of our path. I don't think there's much more. When we have to be inspired to make a restaurant, we have to look at a space and think it's going to be really cool. We don't just make them to make them. Eric and I walk through and the bar could go there and this would be there and you envision it. You know, I think as a restaurateur, you can walk into an empty space and you know what that vibe's going to feel like, or that space doesn't have the vibe you want to achieve, so it doesn't work. That's kind of our demographic plan, or whatever you want to call it, or our criteria. You know, does this feel like it could be a blue ribbon? Does this feel like it can work? So yeah, we're a bit, I don't know how to describe it, but we're a little loose in the whole figuring out what's the right project world.
Last question I have for you is this, and it's just going to chunk up what we've already been talking about. But the industry itself is filled with all of these unspoken rules and traditions about how things should be done. How would you like to see the restaurant industry turn the tables to create a better future for all of us?
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge thing. And I think this goes back to kind of what I was saying a little bit before about how Eric and I have just dealt. But I really truly think that the world needs more chefs. I think the world would be a better place. And the word chef is a whole nother thing to get into, but maybe for another time. But the world needs more people passionate about food. And I think that while I see these, I mean, it upsets me quite honestly, because Eric and I came from, like I said, training in this under this one chef that really impressed us, this guy Robert Chassat at Le Recamier in Paris. And with Robert, everything was about respect and it was supporting people in the restaurant. And when I see the glorification of this kind of oppressive restaurant world, whether it's your Hell's Kitchens or your, yeah, let's just be honest, 95% of the shit out there about chefs is that we are these kind of psychomanic, over-controlling, oppressive people. And I find that to be really sad. I find cooking to be utterly collaboratory. I find the restaurant industry and the group that like we grew up with from 1992 and on, those, all of us, like the bond is amazing. You know, it's, there's so much amazing stuff about the restaurant industry. I think it should be less rules and I think there should be more respect. And I'm happy when I see a chef who's been treating their employees like shit for 30 years say, I've had this revelation. And I'm going to shut down my restaurant and I'm going to open a new one and I'm going to be nice to everyone now. I think that's great. But I kind of wonder to myself, why were you a dick in the first place? You get so much out of people and you get so much satisfaction, or at least I do, and Eric does, out of seeing people excel and thrive, that I think if we could understand that, yes, the kitchen should be a respectful environment where we can all feel good. And look, I'm not saying I'm 100% successful. I'm not saying I've never been angry or lost my temper or anything like that. I'm just saying every single day, if the people at the top could show respect for everyone, and it doesn't mean you can't get the best out of all your people and you can't execute a Michelin 3-star restaurant or whatever, but if that could trickle down throughout this industry, I think it would make the industry better as a whole, unquestionably.
Our industry suffers from razor-thin margins, and the only way for us to ensure profitability is to make data-driven decisions. The numbers don't lie, and Yelp for Restaurants just released some incredibly compelling numbers. For starters, Yelp reaches 9 times more customers online than OpenTable. And when restaurants pair that level of visibility with Guest Manager and Yelp ads, they experience up to an 8% lift in diner bookings. Think about what that 8% lift could do for your restaurant's finances. To learn more about how Yelp for Restaurants can support your business, visit restaurants.yelp.com/full comp to learn more today. That's Bruce Bromberg. For more information on the chef and his restaurant group, visit BlueRibbonRestaurants.com. If you want to tell us your story, hear previous episodes, or check out our other content, go to restaurants.yelp.com/full comp. Thank you so much for listening to the show. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, please leave us a review. A special thanks to Yelp for helping us spread the word to the whole hospitality community. I'm Josh Copel. You've been listening to Full Comp.